Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up for Monday, August 18th. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM. My name is Magnus Tiewald. I'm your host for this hour. I do think Peter R.H. is going to be joining me a little later on, but he's not here yet, perhaps delayed on his way up to the studio. We have a number of interesting things for you today. We have a report on the effects of wildfire smoke on your pets. We've been lucky so far in Vancouver that we haven't really had the smoke come right down into Vancouver as we have sometimes in years past, although there was quite a cloud approaching from Vancouver Island last week before the rain. But wildfire, we got at least another month or 6 weeks of wildfire season here in BC. And so we have a report about that. We also have a report from our friends at the community radio station at Metropolitan University in Toronto about the impact there of on not enough shelter housing for the homeless. We have some great music. Of course, we have Gardening with Embark coming up just after the half hour. And then Peter R.H. should be here with his talk at the last part of the program. We're going to bring you some great music too. But first, let's chat a little bit about what's happening in the news. Probably two of the biggest stories right now are the Air Canada strike, which is very interesting what's going on there. And, of course, the initiative to try and find some sort of solution to the Ukraine war. On Friday, President Trump of the United States and President Putin of Russia met in a summit in Alaska, just the two of them, and they didn't include, of course, the third party in that affair, which is the Ukrainians, in the person of President Zelensky. And that in itself had a lot of people concerned about just what was coming out of it. Today, Zelensky, along with seven other European leaders, including Keir Starmer from the UK and Friedrich Merz of Germany and others, and the president of the European Union, are all going to Washington to talk about what might constitute some sort of solution or framework for a ceasefire in the Ukraine war. And there's a lot of concern just from what we're hearing and some tweets and other sort of stuff from Trump that there's going to be some pressure to have Ukraine make land concessions, which Ukraine understandably has always been opposed to, and would seem to reward Russia and Putin for the war they started, not 3 years ago now, but really more than 10 years ago with the first sort of outbreak of fighting in the Donbass region in the eastern Ukraine. So this has been going on a long time. Hello, Peter.
Yeah, I'm a bit late because I forgot my tablet on the way to the SkyTrain. I got to pick up my tablet. So I'm here.
All right. Well, welcome to the program. So that's what's happening there. I mean, things are in the middle of it right now, and we'll see in the coming days what comes of that. There's always been this fear that Trump is more interested in a solution than a fair solution. And we'll see if that's what comes here. Of course, Putin is of course, He just wants to be rewarded for his invasion and getting the territory he seeks, and to undermine Ukraine sovereignty. And of course, the Ukrainians just want their country to be whole.
Well, I find it interesting that he didn't insult Putin like he insulted the... Is it president of the Ukraine or
prime minister? Yes, he's president.
He insulted him, and J.D. Vance said, you didn't say thank you. Well, if you're not doing anything for you, why should you say thank you to anything? It's interesting that he has a very abrasive meeting with the Ukraine president. And yet there's no abrasiveness at all or any kind of sense of, you know, you might be doing something wrong, Mr. Putin, at all. You know, this is the Trump way, isn't it?
Well, yeah, but there's almost this air of the sort of passive, what's the word I'm looking for, but passive sort
of... Passive aggressive?
No, not with regard... No, I'm talking about with regard to Putin. You know, I mean, it's a bit of an exaggeration, but... You know, I think Trump often acts like a bit of an adoring puppy dog around Putin. Because clearly, I mean, one thing we've seen with Trump over, you know, ever since his first term is he loves strongmen. He loves dictators. He admires them. And very much it would seem to be he aspires to be one. And so, you know, when he sees someone like Putin, who is a strong man and rules his country with an iron fist and can kind of do what he wants and can push his opponents out windows and the rest of it, he admires that. So, of course, when he meets with someone like Putin, you know, he's almost deferential. You know, when someone like Zelensky, he doesn't like him, obviously.
Well, he's become a dictator in many ways, Donald Trump, right now.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is that I kind of didn't buy into the Russian collusion with the first term. But, you know, he's sort of making us rethink that, some of us that kind of doubted, even though I never liked Trump. I did sort of think that maybe the Russian collusion was a bit off, but maybe it wasn't, because look how he's acting.
Well, one of the things about that in that report, and one of the ways that the Trump administration, you know, a couple of weeks ago, just to provide context, you know, and partly as I think a way of distracting attention from the issue around the Epstein files, you know, the Trump administration announced that he was starting an investigation into Obama about, you know, misrepresenting the Russian collusion. But the thing is, the report they're talking about didn't necessarily make the claim that there was collusion. What it did say was that there was clearly a lot of Russian interference in the election through social media manipulation meant to influence voters and benefit the Republicans. Not that there was necessarily direct collusion between Republicans or the Trump campaign and the Russians. So it's true to say that there wasn't really collusion, at least that's what the report sort of says, but it was pretty clear that there was, you know, a strong Russian effort with or without collusion to influence and create disinformation around that election. So
That's beginning to hold a bit water with me, because it's like he just, I mean, it's kind of, he's acting very, but the other thing is people have an argument, well, it was part of the Soviet Union. I think it's what the people want. You know, what do the people of the Ukraine want to be taken over? And this kind of goes with Taiwan also. They have these things. Well, it was part of China. Well, it was this. But do the people of Taiwan want to be part of mainland China? The people that'll make the thing
that's very much the thing. Like, what, you know, we supposedly live in a world where we try and allow people to choose their own rulers, so to speak, you know, and that's sort of the idea of democracy. So, you know, the biggest issue should, like you say, in Taiwan, what do the people who live there want? What do the Taiwanese people want? You know, regardless of you know, long ago history. And, you know, in many ways, you know, I mean, I'm not going to get into the details of it, and I'm not sure I'm enough of an expert, but, you know, Taiwan was kind of a late, you know, wasn't always part of China, you know? I mean, you know, the borders of what is and what isn't China are very, through history, are pretty malleable. It's not like there's some sort of fixed idea of it. You know, and it was independent for a while. It was long under Japanese rule. Then it was under independent. You know, the idea that it... Anyway, that's a different issue, and we don't really have time to get into it.
What I mean is that there are some arguments about that Ukraine was part of Russia, was part of the Soviet Union. I'm just put that other example that way. I feel the same way. It's like, what do the people of Ukraine want? That's what should be the issue.
Yeah, and I agree 100%. The other big issue in the news these days is the Air Canada strike. The Air Canada flight attendants voted 97% to go on strike and started strike action on the weekend, which has resulted in hundreds, if not thousands, of flight cancellations. And something like 130,000 people are travelers are affected by this strike. Over the weekend, the government referred the issue to the National Labor Board, which said it should go to binding arbitration. As of this morning, when the flight attendants have refused to abide by that, and that sort of story, that's something that's happening right now. Through this morning, what's going to exactly happen with that? But the flight attendants seem to be pretty steadfast in their refusal to return to work. So that's an interesting situation, and does raise the issue of the government's attitude to collective bargaining, because they have, on a number of occasions, you know, forced workers back to work. Whether it's port workers or postal workers, or now the flight attendants, you know, very often when this is happening, and it really sort of on some level undermines the whole collective bargaining process. There's a lot of experts talking about how getting it sent to arbitration was exactly what Air Canada wanted, and as an option, knowing that the government would likely follow that course, allow them to not really bargain seriously. So,
well, the issues, and this has been covered, I think most people know this, is that they're working without being paid for it because it's not said until a certain time comes.
Yeah, it's interesting.
That the plane lifts. So they are decisively working. Now, usually I'm kind of, what's the word when they're forced collective, is it collective bargaining? Is that
that's when they negotiate in arbitration. Is that the word?
Arbitration, okay. Most of the time, like there was a, remember, was that, how long ago was that rail strike across Canada?
That was only last year.
I kind of thought bringing it to collective bargaining was sort of a good idea in that. But, and this is actually more, well, it's not apples and oranges how disruptive it is. A lot of people are losing money, people that bought the tickets and so on. But the issue really is that how they've been allowed to get away with not paying someone when they are been working, and it isn't a set thing. It seems like it's a vague thing. Oh, you could be there for an hour, or maybe you couldn't.
Well, yeah, I mean, the way it works is it's not until the doors are locked and basically the plane starts pulling away from the gate that the clock starts ticking on them paying. So if they're there, you know, I mean, they probably have to be there 2 hours before the flight or something like that. But then if the flight's delayed and now the flight's delayed another 2 hours, they're not getting paid for that time. They're not getting paid.
Yeah.
It's a strange. I'm really curious to know how that arrangement came to be the norm in the industry. It seems to be changing now, but it's a very odd sort of formula for paying people You know, it's like, do you pay the bus driver, you know, only when the bus is moving, right?
Well, the other,
but you don't pay him for when the bus stops to pick up passengers. You know, weird. It would be weird.
Well, just to maybe go. The thing is that most times when you do go to collective bargaining, it kind of stops. They may not be happy with it, but they are like Air Canada has sort of just wants to say, okay, that's the way it's going to be, and the strikers have just said, even though they may we don't know whether people are going to be arrested or placed in jail over this, but it isn't working because they're just not going to back down on it.
Doesn't seem so. All right, well, we're going to hit up our first story of the day, and it is wildfire season here in the summer, and as I said before, so far we've not really felt the effects of it. But many parts of the province have, and you need to watch out for your pets because they can be affected by the wildfire smoke. So here's a report on that.
Homelessness crisis, build housing that is affordable.
Permanent housing is the thing.
Permanent housing.
If we had housing, more housing, affordable housing.
The need for...
This is a CHY News update. Air quality warnings continue for several regions in the central Vancouver Island area due to nearby wildfires. The BC SPCA is warning pet owners to keep their pets inside during smoky conditions. This past week, the Nanaimo area saw the Air Quality Health Index reach high-risk conditions as smoke from the out-of-control Mount Underwood fire continues to burn near Port Alberni. The BC SPCA says when poor air quality is a concern, many of the warnings issued to humans can also apply to pets. Eileen Drever, Senior Officer of Protection and Stakeholder Relations for the BC SPCA, told CHY the best way to minimize harm to pets due to poor air quality is to keep them indoors with windows and doors closed.
Try to avoid outdoor exercising, running or hiking, and actually limit outdoor time just to bathroom breaks. We would also suggest consider air purifiers or filters.
She says pets can also be at risk for respiratory issues when outside during smoky conditions. And it's important for pet owners to watch for symptoms.
So some of the common signs of exposure, irritation of the throat, nose, and eyes, making them red and watery. Your dog or cat could actually start coughing. The sneezing and runny nose and gagging, even if they're resting, their respiratory rate can be increased.
Driver recommends keeping active pets occupied inside with puzzle games or long-lasting treats like animal bones.
And even like putting treats in a Kong or something. And that means that they have to work at getting the treat out. So it's to keep them, their mind occupied. Yeah, and you know, just give them lots of attention. They always love attention and they always provide unconditional love for us. So this is a difficult time for them and we should just be looking out for them.
Drever says if an animal does go outside, they should be wiped off right away once back inside, especially cats who can ingest smoke debris from cleaning their coats. As wildfires burn in several different locations on Vancouver Island, Drever says it's very important to ensure pets have some form of identification, such as a microchip or tag.
Please make sure your animal has some form of identification on them, just in case they slip out and they run off. This is a scary time for animals, and they tend to pick up on our emotions as well. So try to keep calm, and they'll be calm with you. But if you get excited, they'll get excited.
She also recommends having a grab-and-go bag prepared with medical records, a leash and harness, and identification in case of an emergency evacuation. For CHY News, this is Laura McKenzie.
This report was made with the support of the Local Journalism Initiative, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and listeners like you. You can find more news updates, interviews, and stories from our nonprofit newsroom, as well as our news and current affairs podcast, Midcoast Morning, at chly.ca/news.
And this is Toronto, or rather Montreal duo, Ribbon Skirt. They've recently been topping the charts at campus radio stations across Canada. This is Wrong Planet from their recent album. I got a lot of- Ribbon Skirt and Wrong Planet.
Stats can be hard to understand, but this one isn't. Nearly 1 in 4 people can't afford food in Canada. What does food insecurity look like where you live? Look up your address at foodsecuritynow.ca. That's foodsecuritynow.ca. Join Community Food Centers Canada in making a difference today.
Every city has its hospital, its fire station, town hall, and these days at least one shelter. Shelters like food banks, decades earlier, were created as a band-aid solution, a quick fix to an emergency situation. Now food banks are a permanent part of the urban landscape, with 1 in 10 Torontonians relying on them to make ends meet. Similar numbers here in Vancouver. Could shelters be heading in the same way? This report from Mia Johnson at CJTM Radio at Toronto Metropolitan University digs into this issue of how shelters have become a permanent necessity in Canadian cities.
Homelessness crisis, build housing that is affordable.
Permanent housing is the thing.
Permanent housing.
If we had housing, more housing, affordable housing.
The need for housing is undeniable.
Back in November of 2023, the city announced over $600 million in federal funding would be put towards 20 new shelter sites. It would be the biggest shelter building program in Canada. But behind the scenes, experts have been urging caution. Shelters on their own, they say, are not the solution.
Definitely people stay in the shelter longer than we want them to and longer than they want to, but that's not an intentional or implicit part of the shelter system. That is a function of the fact that there's nowhere else for people to go.
Brian Harris works at the newest 50-bed shelter by Adelaide and Bathurst. Harris is the executive director of the St. Felix Center, a charity organization currently operating 5 different housing programs across the city.
So if there's not an alternative to the shelter, then sure, people will stay in the shelter for a longer period.
Shelters are meant to be a temporary solution to a temporary problem. But lately, for Torontonians, this hasn't been the case. Harris says they're generally only able to house 1 or 2 people a month. That means folks are staying at St. Felix for anywhere between 6 to 8 months max. Some say that's too long to be in a shelter for.
I mean, that's a real problem. You need to keep providing permanent housing for people so that stay in shelter is indeed a temporary stay.
That's Ronald Kneebone, an economist and public policy professor at the University of Calgary. He's an expert on government budgets, poverty prevention, and homelessness. Housing and poverty are national problems, so we brought on a nationally recognized expert.
It's just a transition. And if you're not providing those permanent housing units, then people get stuck in shelters and they're forced to stay there longer than you would want them to be.
He says shelter beds should be a cost-effective, economical solution. According to data from Toronto's shelter system, a single bed costs the city about $36,000 a year. That's roughly $100 a night for a single bed. But supposedly that bed is used countless times by countless people throughout the year. Based on Professor Kneebone's calculations, that one bed may then help 20 to 25 people a year.
My mind, that's a pretty inexpensive investment in helping that young person transition into permanent housing. In Calgary, it's even cheaper than that because youth in Calgary stay for shorter periods of time in shelter than they do in Toronto.
But that cost depends on people staying for a few days or a week at a time, and that's not what's happening. Meanwhile, municipalities are investing millions of dollars into building shelters. Toronto City Councillors approved the advancement of 6 new shelter sites at July's council meeting, with 14 more coming down the pipeline. Councillor Alejandra Bravo, who supported that motion, says the situation is urgent, with over 15,000 people living unhoused, according to city data.
This is the biggest human and health and economic emergency that's facing the city right now. We need to approve this shelter plan, and we need to move forward on these 6 new shelter sites to get to the solution.
And neighbors where shelters are going are fighting this. They're against these shelters, drawing out the process even longer. Emil Glassberg spoke to us outside the new Adelaide site. He lives just down the street.
it's just the recipe for disaster. It hasn't worked so far. They've gone with it for years now. They've been doing this, and it hasn't worked. And the problem is only growing. They're throwing more and more money at it. Budgets are going up. The shelter and housing has more and more people working for it. They have a bigger budget, and they're failing miserably at accomplishing anything positive. There's got to be another way to do this.
But Adelaide's shelter worker Harris says going back and forth on shelters is just wasting time while people suffer.
You know, I sort of sometimes think of it as analogous to there being a forest fire, right? And you can think of that as poverty. And then there's a debate about, you know, we want to build this new airplane to dump water on the fire. And someone says, well, we don't think the airplane should be built here. And so then it becomes an argument about, okay, well, how, you know, what color is the airplane going to be and how many wheels and windows? And, you know, it gets a little silly to be in a crisis moment, in an emergency, having these types of conversations. So I think trying to find ways to dispel this idea that we can have it both ways as a society, right?
Toronto operates the largest shelter system in Canada, yet the city is unable to provide shelter to the hundreds of people requesting a space every night. But the problem, says Nivone, isn't the lack of shelter.